Hello, beautiful human. Christine Blasdale here. I am so excited to announce, what is this? Oh, it is my brand new book. It's called Podcastonomics, Unlocking the Secrets of Profitable Podcasting for Beginners. I am so proud of this, and I am so happy to make it available to you. It's available right now on Amazon. You can get the Kindle or the paperback version available right now at Amazon. Go get it. Get it now. Get it now.
Welcome to Out of the Box with Christine. Are you willing to step into your greatness? Are you ready to shine? Well, get ready, truth seeker. You're in for an amazing ride. And now, here's the host of the show, Christine Blasdale.
Welcome back to Out of the Box with Christine. I am your host, expert authority business coach, and hostess with the mostest, Christine Blasdale. I am so excited about today's show because we are going to be talking about some greenwashing, girl, and all these companies that make them look like they're doing something really good for the world and the planet, and they're just marketing. There's somebody in a marketing room with a marketing hat on saying, I think we're going to make us look like we're doing something really great, but we're not. Today, my guest is John Pabon, and John is a sustainability author, consultant, and speaker. He has written such great titled books as Sustainability for the Rest of Us, Your No Bullshit 5-Point Plan for Saving the Planet. I love that title, by the way, John. And he's also the author of The Great Greenwashing, How Brands, Governments, and Influencers Are Lying to You. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh my goodness. First of all, kudos for titling your book that.
you got to get people's attention, right?
So yeah, you do. Yes, you do.
Amazon doesn't like the profanity, but I learned my lesson the second time around.
Oh, what? Sales a little slow because of the BS.
You can't promote when you have profanity. It's amazing. So the great greenwashing, I learned my lesson.
Oh, well. Let's learn some lessons today, shall we? Greenwashing. People maybe have not heard that term. I'm familiar with it, but what exactly is greenwashing, John?
So as companies have kind of realized, oh, we can make money off of being green, being sustainable, good for the planet, good for people, a lot of the unethical ones like to wrap themselves in this language of sustainability, saying they're one thing, but actually doing something that's very different. Greenwashing comes in all kinds of different forms. Some is accidental, right? A company may overclaim that they're doing something and maybe, you know, they messed up the numbers. That's okay. We can fix that stuff. But it's the more nefarious greenwashing, the ones like you were mentioning, where it's some marketing team sitting back and thinking about how they're going to invest their millions of dollars to try to pull a fast one on all of us.
Yeah. And it happens not only with greenwashing when it's, you know, something to do with the environment, you know, we're saving the ducks or the whales or the dolphins. But I've also noticed when I always found it very odd that like a particular fried chicken company, I won't say anything, but he rhymes with Colonel Manders. Okay. All right. And I remember there was a pink ribbon campaign going on where you could, for every bucket of this particular brand of chicken, they would donate money to the cancer for women's cancer research. And I'm thinking fried chicken.
And that's the interesting, as a diplomatic way to put it, point is that a lot of these campaigns that are run, you figured they'd be a little slicker than what they are. And they're just so in your face, egregious. And what in the world were these people who were paid a lot of money actually thinking? And you hit the nail on the head that sustainability, when we talk about that word, I know it's a loaded word, it has lots of different definitions, but by and large, it's anything that builds a better future. So that could be the green part of stuff, which gets the lion's share of the PR, so the environmental. But a big part of that is also the social side. So people, animals, things like medical research is an important part of it. So these companies that are partnering on smaller, let's call them charitable sort of causes that are kind of piecemeal, one and done, that's a pretty good telltale sign that there's something else egregious going on behind the scenes. It may not have anything to do with medical research. It may have to do with them just trying to look good by doing this one good thing, by putting a picture of cute kids on the cover of a sustainability report or marketing collateral, when maybe they have child labor going on somewhere in Bangladesh.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, when I did a little bit of research on the chocolate industry, I was shocked. And nobody's saying that around Easter or Halloween, you know.
Nobody wants to hear that. Of course not. And these companies aren't going to be out there saying the things that are going on because they don't want the bad PR. So they would rather deflect and make you pay attention to something that is not so unwholesome.
Yes. Yes. They're like, just pay attention to the cute kids eating the yummy candies.
I always give the example of The Wizard of Oz, and I know it may be a dated example, but classic movie, right? And Dorothy and all her mates, they Yellow Brick Road, they get to Oz, and they're in front of the great and powerful wizard, and there's the smoke and the big head screaming at them, and little Toto runs to the back and pulls back that emerald curtain, and there's that old man from wherever he was from, somewhere in the Midwest, pulling levers, and he says, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. And that's the exact same thing going on here. Look over here, not over here. Pay attention to this, but don't look too deep into what's actually going on.
Exactly. What do you feel at liberty to say what some of the more egregious greenwashing escapades you've seen? We'll start with companies or corporations, and then we'll move, because it's not just them. It's governments and influencers as well. Yes. But
I haven't been sued yet, so okay. Let's see if we can try. So it's interesting, because a lot of the more egregious examples are ones that we're kind of familiar with, but maybe people just didn't have a name or a way to phrase it. We know where this is coming from. It's from oil and gas, mining, all of the really bad industries. And I wouldn't classify myself an activist, so I'm not going to get on a soapbox and yell. I work very much with businesses day in and day out, but there are just some that are irredeemable. My favorite of all, and this is, I don't even know how this ever passed a board of directors to get out there, but it was on Twitter, and it was from Raytheon. Raytheon is a defense contractor.
Yeah,
and
yes.
Defense contractors, by their very nature, they sort of kill people. So you cannot be sustainable when you kill people. It's sort of 101, right? But and I kid you not, they released a tweet, it would have been about 3 years ago, talking about how green one of their missiles was.
No. No.
How does this pass? That would have gone through so many eyes before it made it onto Twitter. And oh my gosh. Yeah. So obviously, you know, they were pilloried for that. But did they learn the lesson? No, of course not, because they don't have to.
They don't. They have enough money to buy people's opinions.
Exactly. And if not, they have the means to get rid of people's opinions too.
Oh, my. What are some other examples that you've come across that are...
It's always the ones where you look at, like, the example you gave of Colonel, what'd you call him? Colonel who?
Manders.
That's it. Colonel Manders. Those sort of, where you look at it and you're like, how in the world could you, a company that's promoting fast food, sponsor something where you know you're going to get blowback? And this stuff happens all of the time. It's the package in a store that may be covered in green, right? And that's supposed to denote that they're good. Or a really great example, and one that we're all sort of used to, is the hang up your towels when you go to a hotel. That's sort of one of the very first examples of greenwashing that ever happened, because yeah, it might seem on the surface that the hotel is doing a great thing by not washing a towel, but at the end of the day, it's them saving money for themselves, and it's not actually making that big of an impact on the environment. Now, with that said, hang up your towels when you go to the hotel, certainly do that. But at the end of the day, they're really blowing out of proportion the amount of impact it's having versus the amount of money they're saving, because you've done their job for them.
Oh, that's so true. Yeah, that's so true. And it's the same thing here in this household. I always say, hang up your towels, kids, teenagers. Oh,
I can't imagine.
Can't tell you how many towels I have washed. Oh my gosh. Now, we alluded to, it's not just these corporations and companies and fast food chains that are greenwashing. There's also stuff happening in government levels as well.
And it blew my mind as I was doing the research for the great greenwashing. I thought, okay, corporations, case studies, my experience, great, done. Nope. I start peeling back the layers of the onion and I realize, oh my God, it's governments. Oh my God, it's celebrities. Of course it's celebrities. Then it's influencers too. So the book just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But the second part of the book talks about how governments and sort of international organizations, they do this as well. I spent a part of the beginning of my career at the United Nations. The United Nations is notorious for greenwashing, and they do it more on the social side where they overclaim the impact they're having, but the reality is probably not as impactful. Sports is a massive one. Sports washing. You and I are both in Australia. Australians love their sports.
Yes.
And they certainly love when an organization like Santos sponsors their sports, or BHP, these are all big mining companies, sponsors sports. It's a massive issue and it continues to go on. You look at human rights abuses at places like Qatar hosted the last World Cup, massive human rights abuses there, but they use the goodwill of sports to try to brush over all the bad things that are going on behind the scenes. So sports, celebrities, you know, I talk in the book about the Oscars, and my favorite example is the Oscars of 2020, because for whatever reason, award season 2020, all the stars seem to align for some reason. So all the award shows, whether it was the Oscars, the Emmys, the BAFTAs, they were all on board with being green. So I think the BAFTAs kicked it off by giving a sustainable style guide to attendees. Okay, great. They had a recycled red carpet. Okay, cool. These little drops in the bucket. One of the other award shows, they made everybody eat a vegan meal. Okay, great. So what? They all flew in on their private jets. So what impact is that having? Yeah. The piece de resistance was the Oscars that year, where everyone was encouraged to dress sustainably. So, you know, you probably had all these admins in Burbank running around to these warehouses to try to find some sort of a sustainable outfit. But Joaquin Phoenix was praised by Stella McCartney herself, who Stella McCartney is sort of seen as this really sustainable fashion designer, right? She knows what she's talking about, but she praised Joaquin Phoenix because he wore the same tuxedo three times. Like, this is the kind of stuff. And, you know, they're all sitting there and clapping for each other. You know, it's they all think they're doing such an amazing thing. And you just think to yourself, whoa. What? How is this even possible that this is happening? But that's a great form of greenwashing, a great, not so great example of people just thinking they're having more of an impact than they actually are, because they probably all went home that night thinking, I did a really good thing. I saved the planet today, which maybe you did a good thing, but you certainly didn't save the planet.
No. And there's also this thing, and I don't even know if it's so much a greenwashing, but it drives me crazy. This idea of focusing in on something, right? And saying that this is the issue, right? So even if it comes down to the issue of, and I'm not a factory farm advocate, right? I think what animals go through is horrific for our enjoyment, right? For that Sunday night roast or whatever. But, you know, saying that, you know, we need to really tackle this issue with the gases, it's methane, I think is what you get from a lot of animals being together.
Yep.
But then there's no conversation on the environmental impact or the CO2 emissions from military, from the wars and the military exercises and the, you know, forget about even the billions of dollars that are spent on that. But the environmental impact on that, it's like, no, just stop eating, you know, make sure that you have that vegetarian Monday, right?
It's these little things. And this is, I actually talk quite a bit about this in my first book, In Sustainability for the Rest of Us, as to if we're going to make a positive difference, and I encourage everybody to do as much as they can, really know what it is you're doing and if it is actually having that impact. And I kind of allude to this in the last chapter of The Great Greenwashing as well, where I turn the mirror on ourselves and say, oh, are we greenwashing? Do we go about our lives thinking, oh, I recycled today, I did what I was supposed to do? When in reality, recycling, you know, keep doing it, absolutely, but you could probably do a bit more if you wanted to. I think my concern is that people do these relatively small actions, which are important, but they're small. Sit back and go, I did a good thing today. Like Joaquin Phoenix wearing the same tuxedo three times. I did a good thing today. And yes, you did a good thing, but there's so much more you can do. So I would encourage you to really encourage the collective you to get out and really find what you can do that's even more impactful. And I always tell people, and I didn't make this up, some other brilliant mind, probably Maya Angelou, made this up, but you can do anything, but you cannot do everything. And I think that's so important, especially when there's so much stuff going on that we're trying to do. Anybody who's an altruist, anybody that cares, it's overwhelming. Like, I go outside, I want to adopt every dog, feed every homeless person, and then go read to the elderly on the weekends. And you're only one person. You can't do that. So pick your lane, find what it is you're passionate about or maybe have a special skill in, and focus on that, confident in the knowledge there are billions of other people that are going to pick up the slack in other areas. So to your original point of there being so many things to do, I think focusing on those areas where you can make the biggest impact is the smartest way to approach trying to save the world, which is in and of itself a massive task.
It is a massive task. And that begs the question, like, you know, a lot of people who are listening to this or watching it on YouTube are saying, okay, John, Christine, what am I supposed to do? Do you have some tips or suggestions on things that people can do in their everyday lives that will just make a little bit of, even if everybody did it, then it would make a big difference. But what are some things that you recommend or you tell people?
Besides buy my book. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
half kidding. I approach this very much from the psychological perspective, I guess. So switching how people interpret what change and positive impact actually is versus dictating to somebody what they should and shouldn't do. Yeah. But I think the biggest thing, like we talked about, is finding that passion point, but also just understanding that there is no such thing as a perfect environmentalist. I think that's so important because we put ourselves under so much pressure to try to do everything, to try to do everything right, to look at our carbon footprint and to say, oh, I'm not perfect. You know, I'm really screwing things up. And that's, you know, not a good psychological space for anybody to be in because you're just going to burn out and give up. And, you know, we're in this for the long haul. So you gotta keep going and keep doing the things that you're doing because they are actually having an impact. I think as a consumer, and this is something I would have laughed at myself had I heard myself say it a year ago, but where you spend your money is so, so important. How you spend your money is so, so important. And I know we're in trying economic times. So I'm speaking to those that are actually spending money on things and going out and buying stuff, not for everybody. But if you can invest in things that are quality over quantity, if you can change your outlook on consumption that way, that is going to benefit you. I think about the fashion industry, for example. You know, we're so indoctrinated with this idea that we need more, faster, but that's a new thing. It's not, you know, I grew up with cloth diapers when I was a baby. Like, so that's not that long ago where we were not in the mindset of consuming so much. So in these trying economic times, if you can afford something that's maybe a little more lovingly made or locally made, that's going to last you probably a lifetime versus something from a fast fashion retailer that's going to fall apart in a week. So change your mind towards consumption, be smarter about how you're spending your money. And I know I say that, but everybody's thinking, oh God, I got to research and I got to pay more. I'm not going to do that. And I get it. I don't want to do that either. I don't want to research every time I go to the store. But as with a lot of things, this is the unfortunate timeline that we're living through. But I suppose on a hopeful message, the work that I do and the things I see behind the scenes, especially with corporations, is they've entered into this virtuous cycle where if I had a crystal ball, I could see the future. I wish I could. 15 years from now, maybe even 10 years from now, when you go to the store, all the choices you have in front of you will be good choices at a really good price point. So we're getting there. It's a slow process. It is a painfully slow process, but we're getting there. Right now, you have to research, you have to pay more. 10 years from now, that's not going to be the case because all the work will have been done for you.
Mm.
We just got to keep going.
And we're fighting a bit of cognitive training that we've had. I agree. I'm up there. And I remember as a young person, you know, I would get hand-me-downs from, I rarely did I ever go and get new clothes. I mean, it was, I think Easter, we were able to get like an Easter outfit or something and new shoes, or the beginning of school. Right. We could get new underwear, socks and shoes. But I would get hand-me-downs from my cousins or my grandmother. I love you, Grandma, but she would make me some clothes. And, I, you know, because that's what you did back in those days. You made things with the patterns and everything.
Yep.
And they'd have the corduroy jeans that had no pockets, and I'd be, Grandma, this is embarrassing. But it was right. It was this, you know, late 60s, 70s. And we were, I don't know, preoccupied with doing things, I think, a little bit more, right? And listening to our transistor radios and all that stuff. We were not being indoctrinated like our kids are today through social media and made to feel bad if you don't have the latest jeans. It was in the 80s when it started going with the Calvin Kleins and, you know, what are you wearing type thing, and then comparing ourselves with other people, right? And then all that pressure, plus that consumerism, you know, capitalism, you know, God love you, because I love capitalism. I mean, I'm glad I can have a business, you know, and have clients 7,000 miles away. But we were sold a bill of goods that we need to buy. We need to buy to look, to look pretty, to be young, to do all these things. And it really did a number on us. So now, having to sort of pull back a bit, I think it's hard for people. We could even say, no, I'm going to do good, and I'm not going to, you know, buy clothes that are made at a, you know, from some child labor. But then you see those really cute shoes or those tennis shoes that are so awesome, and it's got a little swoop and it's really awesome, and everybody's wearing them. They're very expensive. But, you know, how do we deal with that?
There is a bit of a pushback against consumerism, going towards more of a slow fashion model, or at least looking at, when it comes to fashion, you know, consuming things that maybe are pre-loved. I won't do it, but, you know, there are people that do that. And I encourage people that, you know, if that's your passion, go for it. It's just not for me. But I do very well understand that, you know, we do operate within a capitalist system. I'm fine with that, just like you are. And it's the reality. And until some brilliant brain, some economist is born that figures out a new system, this is what we have. And we're not getting rid of it tomorrow, as much as people might want to hang off the side of a whaling ship and think we are. That's not going to happen. So if this is the reality, what do we do? How do we work within the reality to be as positively impactful as possible? And one of the silver linings of capitalism is that if a business doesn't respond to what the market wants, that business isn't going to be around. What does the market want right now? It wants good for the planet products, good for people products. It doesn't want child labor. It doesn't want to think that, you know, somebody died making my Hailey Bieber smoothie or anything. So if a company is not going to play ball, there's not going to be a space for them. And we're already seeing that happen, where companies that have been playing ball for decades, like, there are companies that are so mature when it comes to being good for the planet, good for people, sustainable, truly sustainable companies, that they're going to win. They are winning this race. So the old dinosaurs, the exception of maybe the Raytheons of the world, who will always be here, you know, most of the consumer goods companies that we know and love, they'll stay around. But the ones that are just the dinosaurs, not going to have a space for them. So back to that idea that in 10 years time, everything will be a good choice. I think that is another little proof point for that.
Another thing that we're up against is the idea of a disposable society, right? A disposable, so something breaks, it doesn't work anymore. Back in the old day, I sound like my grandmother. Back in the, when I was a kid,
yeah.
When I was a kid, in the lawnmower, I remember going to the lawnmower repair guy's shed. It smelled like gas and oil and yep. Grime and grass. He would be fixing the edgers and the lawnmowers. And nowadays, it's, well, if the lawnmower is broken, we go out and buy a new one and we trash the old one. And we do this on everything.
Without
vacuum cleaners, dishwashers, couches, whatever, right? That has to have a huge impact on the environment.
Absolutely. Anything disposable. I lived and worked in China for 10 years, and nothing gets thrown away in China. It's amazing. You wake up, and I kid you not, every morning, 5:30, 6 a.m., there will be somebody walking around the neighborhood with a loudspeaker screaming, waking everybody up. He's the local repairman, and he goes around with a little cart and whatever goods you have that need to be repaired. If it's a toaster, if it's a lawnmower, if it's whatever it is, you bring it down from wherever you are, you stop him, and he'll fix it for you on site. And if not that, you go to the local repair shop. You keep things going as long as possible. You find a way to reuse. I don't think this is because, you know, it's a developing country. I mean, there's heaps of wealth, especially in Shanghai, but it's just a different mentality towards these things. Why would I throw a toaster out just because it didn't work one time? No, get it fixed. And I think that's going to be a hard sell when it comes to the rest of the world to try to get us away from a disposable lifestyle. But if we are looking at things from a quality versus quantity perspective, hopefully that'll kind of get us going there, at least, again, when we look at, I always default to fashion. I think it's the easiest thing to fix, but especially electronics as well. Maybe with the economy the way it is, people will naturally start to gravitate towards wanting to fix things versus just throwing things away. Like, as I say this, I think to myself, God, John, you really need to learn how to sew a button. That's where my mind is going right now, and I really do. So after this, I'm going to learn how to sew a button.
I did that just the other day. I felt like my grandmother was smiling at me from heaven. Like, oh, you're cute.
meanwhile, she's up there with her sewing machine making patterns and full-on dresses. Yeah.
Oh, and those weird knit hats with the beer can because I was a kid, I didn't have the beer can crocheted hat, but I got a Pepsi, you know, because, you know, these Pepsi cans, you can use them for a hat. I love that mentality. Our grandparents were a different generation, you know, and they would be like, don't throw that away. We could still eat it. We could make it, turn it into a meatloaf or whatever. You know, it was just a different generation. And, you know, I had a concept or a thought not too long ago, and it was about the whole disposable society thing. And, like, you know, vacuum cleaner, like I pulled back my soul went outside of my body, and I took a big purview of our streets, the streets that we live on, and the cities that we live in, and the countries, you know, in the states and the countries and the world. And I was like, does every single household have to have their own vacuum cleaner and lawnmower and washing machine? And wouldn't it be cool if we had sort of understandable and cooperative co-ops in communities where it's like a library book where you check it out, and instead of having 15 or 20 vacuum cleaners on the block, you have maybe one or two, and, you know, Susie at over at the address of 15 whatever street says, it's Wednesday, I would really love to use the vacuum and make sure that you clean it. It's all, you know, when you return it. But I was like, wouldn't that be interesting if we could work with each other that way? We probably
surely human beings couldn't
do it. So human beings would just probably muck it up at some point.
100%. I mean, we always do, right? But you sort of started to see that with the shared economy. God, I haven't said that in a long time. Shared economy. We used to say that all the time. But, you know, with things like Uber or whatever other shared economy stuff there was, but you started to see a bit of that. It wasn't to the point of granularity like you're talking about, but why not? Like, why wouldn't you have that? I don't, maybe, what is that area in Florida called? The one where all the old people live, the Republicans? But maybe they'll do something like that. You know, that'll be a weird twist. The Villages, that's what it's called.
The Villages. The Villages,
yes. Maybe they'll do some sort of a communal vacuum cleaner. But no, I'm sure there are communities around the world that sort of operate like that. But I wouldn't venture to guess that they're so embedded with a capitalist model. It's probably just out of necessity versus out of doing good for the earth.
Yeah. And somebody had brought that, because I had mentioned that to them, and they were like, oh, that's very Pollyanna. You know, come on now. That's, you know, and then they said, but you know what? They go, what's stopping us from, we have solar on top of our house. We paid for solar, paid lots of money to get the solar installed. And, you know, we generate certain amount of power for our home during the day. And then we send lots of power, lots of energy back to the energy company, and they give you pennies. They give you nothing. They give you nothing for it. They charge you a lot to get it, But then when you're selling it back to them, they're like, yeah, it's not worth so much. But what's to stop us to go, my neighbor could really use some electricity. They don't have solar, but maybe can I give them some of my extra energy? No,
because you're taking money out of, you know, somebody else's pocket, some shareholder that needs that money so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
no,
wouldn't that be cool to share your power?
Shared resources. Funny that. But then you get into a conversation around nationalization and people don't like to hear that.
Oh,
you don't talk about nationalization. But even at a small scale, I mean, I think about, you know, especially here in Australia, and this is very different than the United States. It's community gardens here and community veggie patches. And
yeah.
This is cutesy and this is very Pollyanna-ish, but you know, the community libraries that people have in front of their houses.
I love those.
They're so cute. Yeah, it's not doing much. It's nice, but you're not doing things to the scale we're talking about. But if that exists, then why not just take it a few more steps into something a little bit more utile for everybody, like a vacuum cleaner or a lawnmower?
Yeah.
Or but then
electricity.
The Bunnings, the Bunnings lobby will get angry and take away money from them.
You still have to go for the sausage sizzle.
You gotta do it.
For those of you who have never been to Australia, Bunnings is like your, in America, we have like Lowe's and Home Depot.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And sausage sizzle, it's basically an organization that's raising money for something. And they're out there with these sausages sizzling. And then they put it on a white piece of cheapest bread you could find. And then you can have mustard on it. You can have onion. They got grilled onions. Sometimes you could do that. And mustard and the tomato sauce. It's not called ketchup. Don't ever say ketchup in Australia.
I was waiting to see which one you said.
No, it was just be tomato sauce.
And which
barbecue
is different.
Sauce.
Which
they
is
love
different
their
than
barbecue
ketchup.
Sauce here.
They do. It's true.
What is up with that? All right, John, it has been so fun being with you. If people want to get your books and find out more about you, where do they go?
So my website, which I'm sure will be in the show notes, is the easiest place to find all that stuff. And your local bookseller will have it as well. And connect with me on TikTok. We were talking about this beforehand,
yeah.
But I love TikTok so much. I don't do dances, but for some reason, I've done quite well there. So I've built a really good community. I think TikTok's amazing because you're able to, especially with issues that I talk about, get into a little bit more granularity and detail versus maybe an Instagram post where you don't really have the time or the audience really doesn't want to get that deep. But in TikTok, it's more than just dancing. So come check me out.
I will definitely put the links in the show notes. People can check that out. Go to his website and also, of course, go to his TikTok. I'm going to follow you. I'll be your little stalker.
Love that.
The great thing about TikTok and why you're getting that great response is because of the algorithm. The algorithm is brilliant.
Absolutely.
And just don't, what you'll find very soon is that when you stop on a video and you watch it for a few seconds, make sure it's something that you want more of. Because I did that the other day. I stopped for a few seconds. It was this cute little kitten doing something silly. And man, all I'm getting in my For You feed is just cute little kittens. So just go to John's TikTok or to my TikTok and go to the video and watch the whole thing. Maybe comment, like, and then you'll get more of that stuff.
Do not doom scroll as you're nodding off in bed because you'll end up on a random video and then your whole algorithm's screwed. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, don't screw your... That's going to be a bumper sticker. Don't screw your algorithm.
Your algorithm. God, that's so dystopian, but it's true.
I know. 1984.
That's it.
Thanks again, John. You're welcome back on the show. You're lovely. And I'm so glad that you're in the same time zone. So you are welcome back anytime.
Perfect.
Come on the show. Thank you again. Again, folks, my guest has been John Pabon, and he is a sustainability genius and author, consultant, speaker, and you can find more about him at his website, and I'll put that out on the show notes for people, but for those that are like, I don't want to look at the show notes, it's johnpabon.com. And of course, if you want to find out more about my coaching and the podcasts that I have more than one, you can go to christineblosdale.com. If you don't know how to spell that, that's okay. Go to expertauthoritycoach.com. I know it's long, but you can find out all the goodies there. And if you are subscribed to this podcast on Apple Podcast or Spotify. Yay, you. But you can also subscribe to the video version of the podcast on YouTube. So you can see my lovely guest and his cool glasses that he has. You look like the male version of me.
God, it's true. I didn't even notice the glasses.
And you grew up and you're from California.
So for anybody listening, we were chatting beforehand. We both grew up in California, almost, 20 minutes away from each other. And now we live on the other side of the world in the same time zone in Australia. Eerie.
Thanks again, John, so much.
No, thanks for having me.
Thank you, wonderful listeners and viewers. As always, I always say, remember to think outside that damn box. Bye for now.